You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and today, this is going out on August 16th, 2023. As always, I make an appeal to your generosity. You could donate to me in a million different ways. The Orthodox Nationalist, WordPress.com, RoastJournal.org, Patreon, a bunch of other places. On my page, you're connected to Radio Albion, you could find all of that. And I want to note that a couple of weeks ago, after the coup in Niger, a couple of days after the coup in Niger, I predicted this was going to be a major issue and a major area of confrontation between Russia and the United States. And of course, it took off far even beyond what I thought it would be. But today I want to revisit a topic that I spoke of in detail in 2021. But since then, I've been working on a substantial paper on the reasons why the Soviet Union had to withdraw from Afghanistan. Of course, Afghanistan is, you know, the classic slogan is it's a graveyard of empires, and there's something to be said for that. It was never a colony. It was, to a limited extent, the death of the USSR yesterday, the death of the USA today. The country has been in a constant state of war throughout the 20th and the 21st centuries, at least up until the Taliban takeover a couple of years ago. But my opinion is that it's the Soviet government in Kabul, under the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, or the PDPA, that really caused the failure. As many of you know, I've been very sympathetic to the emirate in Afghanistan as really the only hope for a country who's been broken so many times by warfare. But the lessons that could be drawn from the Soviet experience are tremendous. The PDPA was founded in 1965 with a lot of Soviet money. Afghanistan was one of the very first countries to recognize the Red Government. And the writer, Mohammad Taraki, who, by the way, was a former employee at the American Embassy and a KGB agent, was elected as the party's general secretary, and Babrak Kermal, who died in 1996, became the secretary of the Central Committee. They were all part of the KGB apparatus. The party split between the Khalq and the Parchem factions. The Parchem led by Kermal, the Khalq faction led by Taraki, was the first schism in many that would render that government one of the most ridiculous, even by Afghan standards. And it wasn't dissimilar to the government that the U.S. imposed on that country. The PDPA was never a particularly popular party. It had some limited support in the capital among intellectuals and some officers within the armed forces. It was tightly connected with the KGB at its founding, really up until the early 70s. It had about 300 members, and Taraki, you know, couldn't win an election, although he attempted, prior to the coup that brought him to power. Now, allegedly, there were ideological distinctions between those two powers, as well as ethnic ones. The Pashtuns controlled the Khalq faction, the majority faction. The Parchem faction was dominated by really upper-class communists, mostly Tajiks. But beyond that, the differences were the dedication to Leninism. Taraki was far more radical than Kermal was. But no matter what their alleged ideological positions were, they could do nothing right. The constant power struggles, purges at the army, led to the failure of the Soviet intervention, although the Soviets were far more successful than the U.S. was later on. So it all comes down to the PDPA as this kind of semi-Marxist party that ruled Afghanistan for some time, or ruled is, you know, to be used the term loosely. But the country was a monarchy, and when Zahir Shah visited Italy in 1973, he was overthrown in a coup, and power was seized by Mohammad Daoud, who proclaimed the first Republic of Afghanistan. And he had a vague package of semi-liberal reforms, all ended in failure. The state, the revolution was simply too weak and unpopular to function in a country the size of Afghanistan. His rule, like everything else, up until the Taliban, was characterized by political instability and constant rivalry between communist groups on the one side and Muslim Islamist groups on the other. And Daoud banned all opposition parties. And almost right away, the Islamists had engaged in several substantial uprisings, suppressed with great difficulty. And he ruled from 1973 to 1978. And it was in April of 1978 where the KGB financed the Saar Revolution, which in that language means April. And as all of these revolutions tend to do, they ended with the execution of Daoud and most of his family. The prisons were overflowing with opponents or alleged opponents of the new regime. But really from that day in 1978 to the Taliban victory in 2021, Afghanistan never knew a single day of peace or stability. But the relations between the Soviet Union and Afghanistan go way back. Soviet investment after their coup of 78 was a critical component of Afghan development. You know, they lacked everything, basic infrastructure, and it had to be either constructed or reconstructed by the Soviets, connecting the various cities of the country together. The Soviets provided military assistance and improved the country's irrigation and electrification systems, whether people there wanted it or not. Soviet Union built their own polytechnic institutes. They didn't have specialists there, technical schools. They attempted to create a modernized country in hopes that it would not become an Islamic stronghold right on their border. And of course, we know what happened in 1979 in Iran, which is also on the Soviet border with Azerbaijan. But in 1978, a couple of months after the coup, the Pakistani government of Zulfikar Bhutto, Benazir's father, actually, was overthrown. And it brought General Mohammad Zia-ul-Haq to power, who was a Islamist. The future head of intelligence, Hamid Gul, would lead the project of training the Mujahideen, the Afghan Mujahideen in particular, in Pakistani camps. And he called it the first Islamic International Brigade of the modern era. And he drew close to the Central Intelligence Agency. And, of course, the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, or the Inter-Services Intelligence. And both were involved in training the militants in for Afghanistan, which by the 1980s had several large militias. So the government that the Saur Revolution put in place was called the People's Democratic Republic of Afghanistan, termed the DRA. And they tried, you know, there was simply no functional government at any time in Kabul. And certainly it wasn't going to come out of a very small, obscure political party that took over with Soviet money. They attempted to do what Stalin did. In fact, they cited Stalin all the time. But anything they tried to do in the countryside simply failed and met with resistance from Islamic militants and certainly its own ranks. The schisms between those two factions constantly contradicted and second-guessed every policy they ever engaged in. And not too long after the coup, you had army revolts. Actually, in March of 1979, army revolt in Herat. That was the first time they requested Soviet military intervention, and about 20 more requests followed that, each one more panicked than the last. But everyone in Moscow knew that the PDPA had an extremely narrow base of support and couldn't rule the country at any level. The population saw, especially the first 18 months of their rule, their agenda in the countryside as irrational. It was excessive. It was alien. It was ham-handed. Decrees on easy divorce and land collectivization ended in utter disaster. And it goes without saying that their land reform program caused a huge drop in agricultural production. Private property, which was promised to them, of course, by several governments, that promise was broken and the land taken by the state without compensation. These were stupid moves, both politically and morally, and it just exposed how bad off this government really was. Taraki and his successors, you know, you had the typical communist massacres, mass imprisonment, and as each person took power, he began purging the army and the civil service of the other faction. From the middle of 1978, really to the fall of 1979, revolts against that government were pretty constant. It was an attack on the military garrison in Nuristan in the east. And in September of 79, the deputy prime minister, Hafizullah Amin, who, by the way, was educated at the University of Wisconsin in Columbia, where he was first introduced to Marx, he eventually seized power, and of course he killed Taraki, and ruled the country for all of 4 months. But the instability overwhelmed him. He moved against his opponents in the PDPA as the Muslim rebellion was growing. The truth of the matter is that while these people proclaimed themselves Marxists, they were opportunists, and Amin certainly was. He was distrusted by everybody, including in Moscow. But Amin continued his predecessor's purges of the Parchom faction. Eventually, Karmal ended up hiding in Czechoslovakia. And the Soviets knew what a disaster this was. They pleaded with Amin to broaden the foundation of his support, to bring other parties into a coalition. And of course, he refused. They began to blame him, because the population was turning not just against their government, but by implication, the USSR. These guys were incredibly stupid. Taraki was told by Brezhnev and the foreign ministry that Amin was going to kill him. And he said, no, I have it under control. In fact, these guys always ignored the advice of their Soviet advisors. They were incorrigible. They were stupid. They were self-seeking. They had no real principles. And the only reason they really cared about the USSR is that it was close. It was already present in the country and money was flowing south. Many of you know who Vasily Mitrokhin is, former KGB agent, and he wrote a monograph on the KGB in Afghanistan. I want to quote him here, copyrighted in 2002. And he wrote on this precise situation. He said, on September 1st, 1979, the KGB gave the highest authorities its views on possible ways to overcome the critical situation in Afghanistan. The memorandum stated that the government of Taraki and Amin was clearly losing its authority among the people, and that the population was becoming increasingly anti-Soviet. Soviet representatives gave at various levels advice and suggestions to Taraki and Amin that they should increase work with the masses in order to give the regime a broad social basis, and these were almost totally ignored. Taraki and Amin were relying on military force to solve all internal problems and were continuing to take unjustified mass punitive measures, and that Amin was the main organizer of this policy. Now, this put the Soviets in a very difficult position. This is about time, mid-1979, fall of 1979, the debates about the possibility, the necessity of an invasion were begun and started to rage. Amin was destroying the Soviet position there, which, of course, isn't the worst thing in the world. But we're talking about not only why the Soviets invaded, they did not want to, but why they failed, or at least why they withdrew when they did. Moscow's position, unlike, of course, today, is that they could not have a radical Islamic state, funded at least in part by the U.S. and Pakistan and the Saudis, on its southern border. But in general, throughout 1979, remember the invasion was at the very end of 79. The debate went on, but the general consensus was that it's a bad idea. The Politburo really in March of 79, in the middle of March, met to discuss the many requests of the government in Kabul for an invasion, and they were refused many times. And Amin, in his ridiculous ignorance, just didn't know how badly Moscow thought of him. But it didn't matter. They blamed each other for the failures. They blamed each other in the party, as well as blaming the Soviets and vice versa for the absolute failure. I mean, absolute failure of that government to do anything. I want to quote Andrei Gromyko, who was a minister of foreign affairs. And I really should note that there's a new thesis, mainstream thesis, that Brezhnev, who had had a stroke several years earlier, was coming under the control of people like Andropov and Gromyko, and the defense minister, Ustinov, later, and that they were giving him false, maybe Suslov, maybe, and they were giving him a lot of false information. But let me quote the Minister of Foreign Affairs in the USSR, Andrei Gromyko. The question is, what will we win? Afghanistan with its current government, with a backward economy, with little weight in international affairs? We have to bear in mind that we can't legally justify the introduction of troops. According to the UN Charter, a country can ask for help, and we could send troops in the case they were subjected to aggression from the outside. Afghanistan is not subject to any aggression. This seems to be their internal affair, revolutionary civil strife, battles between one group of the population and another. But it has to be said that Afghans did not officially contact us regarding the deployment of troops. We're dealing here with such a case when the country's leadership, as a result of serious mistakes, was not up to par and does not enjoy support of the people. If we, for example, take the risk and invade, then of course we will get fewer pluses than minuses. We don't know how the Afghan army will behave, and if they do not support our mission or remain neutral, we will turn out to be an occupying force. By this, we will create for ourselves an incredibly difficult situation in foreign policy. And little did anyone know at the time just how absolutely correct he was. That was a huge foreign policy debate throughout 1979. Given the results of intervention, as well as what might happen if they don't intervene. But they were facing armed demonstrations of the Islamic forces in the capital. Amin's erratic behavior, you had nonstop mutinies in the army. You had endless and unhealed internal party struggles, not to mention the arrest and the strangulation of Taraki. All caused concern among Soviet elites. Soviets were well aware of his ambition and brutality in the pursuit of power. You had terror tactics used everywhere, not just against Muslims, but also against supporters of Taraki within his own party. Whoever was in power would purge the other side. Unfortunately, the purges of the army were nonstop. And the army was about the only thing that supported this party rule. And even before the Soviet invasion, the army's morale just had collapsed to nothing, and you had mass desertions. So while initially the Soviets were opposed to direct military intervention, the USSR was in a no-win situation. And of course, then the Islamic Revolution in Iran made matters worse. But they also didn't want to cause the fall of the PDPA, given who may take their place. They started to notice, and it began to leak out from Afghanistan to Moscow, that Amin had contacted the CIA and went to the CIA after he murdered Taraki. In fact, the CIA even looked to the possibility of moving its operations out of Afghanistan once the Ayatollah threw them out. Amin certainly met with the acting head of the U.S. Embassy 5 times since February of 1979. After the hostage crisis in Iran, U.S. policy became very unpredictable. Not to mention the impact of all of this on the Islamic Central Asian republics of the USSR. The KGB also claimed, and I'm quoting Lobeck and Matrokhin himself, contacts between Amin and elements of the Islamic opposition, even with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And all the repression that he was engaged in The unrest continued and, in fact, increased in intensity. The Afghan 7th Infantry Division rose up in October of 1979. That was right on the outskirts of the capital. In fact, that revolt explicitly demanded the return of Taraki. I don't know if he was still alive at the time or not, or they just simply didn't know. Anybody, you know, especially these tribes and ethnic groups throughout the country, he would use the Air Force, he would use regular army units to destroy them if they resisted. And anything he did failed miserably. By the middle of 1979, Amin's government controlled about 20% of the country, and it was shrinking. But it got even worse. Amin began to ideologically distance himself from the USSR. He claimed that the Tsar Revolution had no real ideological connection to the Soviet Revolution. He denied that he was a client to the Soviets at all. In fact, he said, "We welcome assistance from anyone, especially the United States." He appealed to the U.S. to resist for Afghanistan, to resist Soviet pressure with American help. He had an interview with the Washington Post in October 25th of that year. And I'm quoting him here. "We want the United States of America to consider realistically the affairs of this region and further provide us with aid." I mean, this man is stupid. Obviously, this is very unacceptable to the USSR. Even Brezhnev was shocked at the strangulation of Taraki. He, you know, September 10th of 79, Brezhnev met with him, promising help and support. He warned him against Amin yet again. But by this point, Amin had alienated everyone. He had to be eliminated. And of course, the invasion of Afghanistan began the end of 1979 with the assault by the Soviet Special Forces on the presidential residence. That's specifically December 27th. How he was killed is unclear. We certainly know he was killed, as were several members of his family. And they replaced him with the leader of the other faction, Babur Karmal. That was favored by Yuri Andropov. Unfortunately, Karmal was an alcoholic. But his installation was the first act in the Soviet invasion itself. But his government did the same as the others. He took revenge on the Khalq faction. Both Amin and Taraki were members of that faction, purging them all from positions of power. Amin loyalists were liquidated, thousands were sent to prison, and the army was turned over to his minority group, creating even more incompetence, instability, and distrust, purge after purge after purge. And I'm willing to say that the Soviet invasion was finally forced upon Moscow, given the entire, I mean, the almost absolute collapse of the Afghan military. There's a very good book by Braithwaite, which came out in 2011. And I want to quote him because he summarizes the stated reasons for the Soviet invasion. I'm quoting him now. "The task before the 40th Army and its commanders as they swept into Afghanistan may have seemed simple, clear, and limited. The Russians had intervened to put an end to the vicious feuding within the PDPA, to force a radical change in the extreme and brutally counterproductive policies of the communist government. The aim was never to take over and occupy the country. It was to secure the towns and roads between them and to withdraw as soon as the Afghan government and its armed forces were in a state to take over the responsibility for themselves." And his book came out in 2011. And I'm saying that the reason that the Soviets weren't able to do a lot of what they planned to do was because of the Afghan government. The invasion itself went fairly easily. It took place without incident, without major losses. It didn't take long. The 40th Army was stationed in, I believe, 24 large and 101 small garrisons spread out all over the place. But it wasn't as if they were perceived as liberators from Amin. You even had demonstrations right in the capital after the invasion. 900 were arrested. And I'm going to quote Matryokhin again. And what he's doing is he's quoting Yuri Andropov, asked what the KGB was supposed to do. And this is in a missive to his agents in Afghanistan. He said, "When the first stage of the operation has been completed," which, by the way, was the murder of Amin, "assistance must be given to the healthy forces in the PDPA to expand the social base of the new regime in order to gain control of the situation in the country as soon as possible. measures must be taken to include in the new leadership of the organs people who have shown their loyalty to the ideals of the April Revolution and have proved themselves friends of the USSR. Everything possible must be done to achieve a favorable atmosphere for the Soviet military, Soviet establishments, and Soviet citizens in the DRA. Information must be obtained about the feelings of the various sections of Afghan society in order to evaluate what was happening and take the appropriate measures in good time. Urgent measures must be taken to normalize and strengthen the work of the security services according to the principles formulated by Babrak, the leader that they installed. Of course, one of the major responsibilities of the Soviet invasion was to clear the northern parts of the country, that is, those parts bordering the USSR, of any opponent of the Afghan government or the Soviet Union itself. But thanks to funding from really all over the world, the rebels, who were just unbeatable, the Taliban was just coming into existence at this point. Taliban comes from exiles in Pakistan, but I think they're a bit after this, but they developed a intricate system of supply, command posts, and the Soviets were not prepared for this. They weren't getting good information. But things like, you know, smaller units, flexible countermeasures, unplanned strikes, the revolution in reconnaissance, which all comers and all observers saw occur in the Soviet army at this point, because everything was based on that kind of intelligence. But still, the 40th Army was not enough to pacify the country without the Afghans. I think the peak, and there's a few differences in the estimate, but the consensus number seems to be 117,000 men, the 40th Army, in Afghanistan at its peak, not including a large number of civilian specialists in for civilian tasks. Now, initially, there were pitched battles, and those are the ones that the Soviets won. Not all of them, but most of them. Using tanks and aircraft, eventually the helicopter was the main weapon there. In places like Herat and Kunar, Khost. And you had centers of revolt. Again, another major priority that had to be crushed. Talukan and Takhar, places like that. As I mentioned, the rebels occupied, maybe 85% of the country prior to the invasion. And that was reversed very quickly. But even KGB sources say that the following year, you had over 6,000 specific different armed actions by the rebels all over the country. So you had relative calm, though, in the first half of 1980, when the invasion was a new phenomenon. And rather than the Afghan leadership using this time and money to reform the army, to improve their popularity, they did nothing like that. They just purged one another. They purged the armed forces and the bureaucracy in the struggle for power, which meant that all hopes for stabilization lay with the Soviet army, which, of course, was not part of the initial plan. I want to quote Matrokhin again concerning we all know that what a joke the Afghan National Army was when the U.S. ran it. It was no different when the Soviets ran it. Let me quote him here. The combat capability and morale of the army of the DRA was at a very low level, according to the Soviet military and the KGB. Officers openly disobeyed orders, cooperated with the Dushman, which was the Soviet term for rebels, even went over to their side. Over 17,000 men had deserted from the army by the 30th of April 1980. There were vast numbers of deserters in subsequent years. In 1981, 30,000 deserted from the army, and in 1982 was between 2,500 and 3,000 deserting each month. The number of deserters was six times greater than the number killed, which was also very high. Thus, the National Guard alone lost 8,000 men in 9 months. 1,200 were killed, 2,336 wounded, 850 taken prisoner, and 2,500 deserted. Of course, the ranks that were left were filled by compulsory conscription, at least in those territories that they can control. Even among the border troops, which were extremely important to keep weapons from coming in either from the Iranian or the Pakistani side. In 1982, Matrokhin says, of 5,600 conscripts, over 2,000 deserted. And the only thing that this meant over time was that the volume of Soviet operations had to grow rapidly. And at one point or another, all units and subdivisions of the 40th Army were involved. It wasn't supposed to be their job, but looking for guerrilla strong points. supply chains was the paramount task. And the reconnaissance unit brought in from all over the Soviet Union to find these people, relying on special forces way too often, absolutely exhausting the fairly small units. But the first few years, they adjusted pretty well, as much as could be expected. Really, the battalion became the main unit rather than the division. Everything else, everything larger than the battalion, was simply too cumbersome. But as hostilities grew, 80, 81, the Islamic resistance was financed lavishly. And actually, there was a sharp increase in 82 from the U.S., Pakistan, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and a number of NATO countries, especially Germany. By the winter of 1983, this is extremely impressive. The rebels had warehouses, communication centers, weapons workshops, hospitals, and training centers. No one was really in a position to control this stuff from coming over the border. There was a camp in Jawar in the Khost district. They had 49 different subunits. They had a cartridge plant. They had a radio center. They had a command center that coordinated the actions of their detachments. This emergence of a very impressive guerrilla infrastructure required the establishment of a whole system of transferring supplies from Iran and Pakistan into the country via protected and secret convoys. Now, a lot of these I'm quoting a man named Volkov, who wrote, it's not in English, in 2015, he was a veteran, of the interdiction efforts of these convoys bringing in supplies from especially Pakistan. So a lot of what I'm saying here comes directly from him. But with the assistance of Pakistan and Iran, the rebels operated a very, again, impressive, regular system of training throughout, really, Central Asia. So the rebels had a trained reserve to compensate for losses, and at least according to Soviet estimates, their number at any given moment exceeded 60,000 men at a minimum. So in total, he says, there were 212 specialized training centers. There were 178 in Pakistan and at least 34 in Iran. And so they were able to train about 75,000 men a year. And what's often forgotten is that these rebel groups were actually functioning governments, which compared with the government in Kabul, were utopias. Of course, anything compared to them. They engaged in mining, which is a big resource in Afghanistan, emeralds and silver especially. They created a tax. They created a sophisticated economy, far more successful than the central governments. And the Soviets were aware of that. Despite this was supposed to be the Afghan army's job, but it fell to them, and the most important goal after a while was intercept these caravans. But the typical interdiction efforts were ineffective. You think the time required to organize an operation, advance troops, overcome resistance in very rough terrain, meant that the rebels, who could move a lot faster, had time to change course. And if worse come to worse, abandon the supplies right there. And the interdiction rates, according to Volkov, were impressive, but the critical supplies never stopped. And the ability of the rebels to hide these caravans, as small as they often were, became incredible. And they were, and one of the responses was to have the caravan get smaller and smaller, really a handful of cars, camels, horses, whatever. From the Pakistani side alone, you had more than 100 routes coming over the border that took advantage of the difficult terrain. And the DRA armed forces didn't involve themselves at all in this operation and did not or could not give information on them, despite the fact that 24 battalions were stationed on the Pakistani border alone. So in 1984, the Soviets came out with Operation Veil. Sometimes it's called Operation Curtain. I think Veil makes more sense, which was a ambush project relying on reconnaissance and special forces to stop, interdict the caravans and destroy their routes. So the main emphasis was the creation of ambush units from special forces, both the Iranian and Pakistani side. Again, I'm quoting Volkov here. I'm not really quoting him, but I'm using him as my authority. Had about 10 motorized rifle battalions and a large number of helicopters involved in the Veil project, but the main onus of the struggle fell on the reconnaissance units, with zero help from the Afghan army, which meant that this was a purely Soviet operation, which they wanted to avoid. The point of the invasion was to give the government in Kabul a head start, to reform itself so that they could then take over and the Soviets pull out, at most to assist them in some of these operations. It was not planned for the Soviets to do all of this by themselves. So they, the Turkestan and Transcaucasian military districts were mobilized for this purpose. They had a lot of Soviet Muslims fighting there. And at least on paper, they could engage in either between 80 and 110 ambushes simultaneously. Volkov says that, you know, that was on paper. But so Volkov says, he was a veteran of this operation, that there was a revolution in tactics, in counterinsurgency. None of it learned by the United States. Rapid response helicopter units dispatched with the first sighting of a caravan. The Islamic forces from the Soviet Union did assist, but they were relatively small. But he, and I'm quoting him directly here, he says, according to some estimates, special forces gave up to 50% of the combat results of the entire 40th Army, despite accounting for only 5% of the total number of Soviet troops in Afghanistan. And that's saying something. That Vail was a limited success, but the over-reliance on special forces really depleted them and was quite embarrassing. I want to quote him again here, talking about the failures of Vail. He said, the weak side of the special forces was a short duration of military operations. That is, usually after 2 or 3 days, the reconnaissance groups were identified by the rebels and were forced to urgently evacuate. A number of other reasons caused the negative impacts of the operation. Severe climatic conditions, the deployment of detachments in densely populated areas, which prevented the covert advancement of the special forces on missions, the lack of the required number of helicopters, the lack of instruments for night flights on these helicopters, as well as the lack of modern small-sized radio stations, batteries for radio stations, and night vision devices. You know, it kind of makes sense, because they weren't expecting to do a lot of this kind of work. But he also goes on to say that, you know, according to the estimates of the 40th Army itself, in the period from March of 1984 to May of 1988, these new ambush units eliminated about, well, it killed about 17,000 individual Mujahideen and destroyed around 1,000 caravans. There was a discovery and destruction of 332 weapons and ammunition depots, and the number of prisoners on Vail was 825. But the KGB, Soviet military, 40th Army, all stated that about 12 to 15% of the total number of caravans were intercepted during the implementation of Operation Vail. It's true that it failed, but without any help from actual Afghans. But the only thing, you know, intelligence-wise, the Soviets did create a lot of false rebel groups. The KGB was excellent here. The secret police of the Kabul government, KHAD, K-H-A-D, did have combat units, just like the KGB had combat units, and they did fairly well. But again, they were small in number. But to go back to the political here, the head of the Kabul government, Karmal, was as pathetic as any of the others. He was weakened by unhealed divisions within his party, and there was whatever little attempts, few attempts to create goodwill in the population were absolutely futile. The ministers under his rule came and went. Nothing was stable. People were promoted for personal reasons. And Moscow eventually had come to the same conclusion with him as everyone else. It was a miserable failure. 1980s wore on. Karmal's inability to form a functional government became obvious. And Mikhail Gorbachev made a very clear statement here. He said, the main reason that there's been no national consolidation so far is that Comrade Karmal is hoping to continue sitting in Kabul with our help. Which turns out to be a very good summary of the failures of that government. And what he means is very, very simple. So long as we're there, the Afghan leadership doesn't have to do anything. They were so stupid and short-sighted, I guess they just assumed that the Soviets were going to be there forever. And eventually, like all the others, Soviet Union decided to dispose of him entirely. I want to quote Matrokhin again, former KGB, controversial, but I think he's worth our time. And he's talking about this era here. He says, the leadership of the PDPA did not achieve a breakthrough in the stabilization and normalization of the situation in the country. It did not manage to overcome the main negative consequences of the policies of the Taraki and Amin governments. They were negativism indifference, apathy on the part of the population towards the established regime. The leadership of the party did not know the real state of affairs in the various spheres of life in the party and the country. It didn't even have an idea of its main tasks. The KGB representation and the residency began to view the actions of Babrak and his accomplices at odds with the interests of the USSR in Afghanistan. And this was seen in the growing anti-Soviet mood in the party and the country, and the slowing down of the revolutionary process. The sectarian and dependent line adopted by Babrak Karmal acted as a brake and forced the USSR to conduct the war against the Muslims by itself. These people began to keep information on the true situation in the party and the country away from Soviet advisors. So again, the armed forces of the DRA, they were the main variable in understanding the reasons for the initial invasion and for the quagmire that eventually developed. The Kabul government was the failure. Far more was expected out of the army than actually they delivered, and the U.S. had the exact same problem. Although I will put these guys above the American Afghan National Army. And really, the pool of recruitment was very thin. Remember, we talked about the Afghan National Army and the American occupation came from the lowest dregs of the population because no one wanted to serve the U.S. So people who had been kicked out of the villages, drug addicts and all that, these were people who ended up being drafted. I want to quote someone from the Rand Corporation. He wrote this in 2011, trying to give some semblance of a lesson to the Americans. But the Americans think that they, you know, this is the strongest military in the world, they claim. So what do we have to learn from anybody? And of course, they tend to be beaten wherever they go. Now, let me quote her here. But if officially the Afghan army was the core of the fight against insurgents, with the Soviets in a support role, the fact remained that Soviet soldiers continued to shoulder the bulk of the fighting burden. A few different factors help explain this. Because the Soviet military leaders planned most of the operations and feared sharing information with the Afghans, involving Afghan forces was generally a matter of integrating them into what the Soviets were doing, for all the lip service paid to joint planning. Moreover, Soviet tactics focused substantially on aviation artillery barrages of real and suspected enemy positions, an approach that relied on Soviet capabilities. Although the Afghans had aviation and artillery, they were not as expert in using these assets, and substantial levels of illiteracy among Afghan personnel made training in these areas particularly challenging. You know, you clearly can tell that she's trying to be nice. The Soviet leaders planning most of the operations, that is because they couldn't trust the Afghan army. It's not a cause, it's really a result. And the very fact that they feared to share information with them suggests that the KGB was well aware that there were a lot of double agents. That's why talking about, you know, the numbers of casualties, how many Mujahideen were killed, that's hard. Because you'd have a DRA uniform on one day and be fighting for the Mujahideen the next. You could be a civilian, just a cattle breeder or something like that. And at night, you know, you grab a rifle and serve the insurgency. You never knew. That's why numbers are always very vague here. And trying to be nice, yeah, the Afghans had aviation, artillery. Well, you have to be literate to use them. You have to know what you're doing. They have to be integrated, as I've talked about in the Ukraine case, within a full interchangeable military apparatus. Well, in May of 1986, the Soviets had enough and installed the guy, I think it was probably the most famous of them all, Mohammad Najibullah, who was the former chief of the secret police, the Khad, and he replaced Karmal. And of course, he inherited a disastrous, divided, incompetent government. He wasn't well known to the broader Afghan population. He did, you know, it's easy to say that he did the best he possibly could with almost nothing. He was a very good speaker in both the Pashto and Dari languages. He tried to engage with tribal elders. He tried to present himself as a Muslim, even using the Quran to punctuate his speeches. He let a number of political prisoners be released. He stopped the night curfew in the capital that had been there since 1980. Although he did the same as his predecessors. He moved against the pro-Karmal Pashtunites, who were expelled from the Revolutionary Council in yet another purge. Why are you going to work, either in a civil service or in a military position if you could be removed tomorrow? And who are these guys? How many experienced officers did they have access to? Anyone who was decent was long gone. But this is why they picked Najibullah. New leadership was absolutely necessary. And in December of 86, clearly by then you have a clear quagmire, Najibullah came up with the National Reconciliation Program. That was a plenum at the end of 1986 from the PDPA, and here's how they described this new course. National reconciliation is a stage in the development of the National Democratic Revolution, a special kind of political compromise in which the tasks of establishing a democratic system, ending the war, and accelerating socioeconomic development in a multi-party system, coalition forms of government, merge into one undissolvable whole. That's, you know, of course, a lot of sloganeering. Typical democratic, you know, is this nonsense. But unlike the previous leaders, Najibullah was not a moron. So in January of the next year, 87, the DRA adopted the Declaration on National Reconciliation. And with the new year, the military, that is to say the Afghan military, was ordered to cease any offensive operation. Now, you can imagine what the Mujahideen did. Of course, they took this as a sign of weakness. It's because it was. They decided not to listen and not to compromise. In fact, they even intensified their operations. So the reconciliation idea, regardless of the intentions, was yet another failure. But it was stupid to begin with, since, among other things, it only applied to those who had not raised arms against the government. In fact, they said, we can't even do this unless the Soviets seal the border with Pakistan before anything, any negotiations with the Mujahideen could begin. Well, if they could seal the border, they wouldn't have had this problem. Najibullah was a ruthless and vicious man, despite his high intelligence. He was the head of the secret police, Khat, and he was responsible for the arrest, torture, and execution of thousands. He targeted anti-communist citizens, political opponents, educated members of society, especially within his own party, but anywhere else, and he was efficient at it. And that's probably the only good thing that the Soviets saw in him, and is why they promoted him. Another problem, and the Soviet literature says this quite often, he allowed graft, theft, and bribery, just intense corruption on a scale not seen previously, which is really saying something at the time. But despite him heading the secret police for 5 years, the Karmal faction still has sizable support. They could never show a united front. How many purges can they engage in here? Najibullah expressed a willingness to allow other parties to be active, and even kind of hinted at the exiled king, Zahir Shah, might even be a part of the process. The problem was that none of the parties that he could work with had to be, they all had to be pro-Soviet. So it was a trivial idea. The six-month ceasefire was, you know, words on paper. And of course, a guy like him, he satisfied nobody. And like everyone else in the PDPA, he failed even in the basic tasks of governing. His intentions came from his ruthlessness. He did, at the end of 1987, create a legislature for the very first time, albeit selected by the authorities. He tried to pass a new constitution for the country, creating a presidential system with an elective, quote-unquote, parliament. The constitution declared the sacred religion of Islam the official religion, and somehow that was consistent with guaranteeing the democratic rights of the individual. I don't understand how those two can merge, but it also made it legal to form political parties so long as they were pro-Moscow, and sought to equalize the country's various tribes and nationalities. The worst possible thing you can do, and in the literature, in the English, and in other languages, in political science, what really causes revolution and violence is deliberately raising expectations and not following through. And that's exactly what he did here. By this time, the PDPA was a joke, and no one took it seriously. His ideas came too late, assuming he even really believed in them at all. But the only thing he could do economically is just augment the links with the Warsaw Pact. Coming to the end of his existence, of course, we didn't know that at the time. He did encourage the private sector, which even in the Soviet Union was being talked about. But the worst way that he helped raise expectations was his 5-year economic and social development plan. That was introduced in January of 86, and it continued until March of 92, just a month before that government fell. It created expectations. It made forecasts that were at best humorous and at worst deliberate lies that no normal person could ever possibly believe. Now, the economy had been stagnant for God knows how long. Somehow, in his 5-year plan, he was going to grow the economy by 25%. Industry was supposed to grow by 28%, agriculture between 14 and 16%, domestic trade by 150%, and foreign trade would shoot up 15%. And that was, they had a very, very tightly controlled media. That's what was put on the front page. And I really don't have to tell you that none of these targets were even remotely achieved. Even he was claiming 2% growth a year, which was inflated. Nothing had changed economically whatsoever. So in creating expectations that could never be met, he sealed his own doom. And it should be obvious by this point that none of any of these schemes helped. I mean, constitution, plans, laws, they're words on paper. And with a government like this, they're even worth less than words on paper. Now we're coming really to the end of the war here. But the Soviets still managed to carry out a number of successful operations. Operation Magistral, which unblocked the Gardez Coast Road, very important politically. The National Reconciliation Plan, of course, had long since, at best, been considered ineffective. And so the Soviets were in the process of giving up. And so what they wanted to intensify was the possibility of a political solution to the Afghan problem and to get out of there as quickly as humanly possible. They had not been defeated militarily, but they clearly had been defeated politically. It's a classic example of when you impose a government on a country, thinking that somehow, you had a handful of actual proletarians in Afghanistan, a deeply Islamic country, never colonized, which is an extremely important point. And you think that somehow because Marx wrote something or Lenin wrote something, it's going to come true simply because the party says so. That's really what an ideologue is. Now, the Soviets believed that when they pulled out of Afghanistan, Najibullah would collapse immediately, which is certainly what happened in the American case. So as this process is going on, they tried to improve his economic and political position. Supplies of weapons and all kinds of military equipment, manufacturing capital, all kinds of economic aid were increased. There was a small contingent Soviet troops remaining to help rebuild the Afghan army. But in late 88, early 89, Najibullah was bombarding the Soviets with messages, desperate messages, begging them to delay the withdrawal or at least leave volunteers to guard some of their main highways, especially the Kabul Heraton, which is how Soviet aid got there. And there was more division. Shevardnadze, who was the foreign minister, did support Najibullah, but the majority of the party favored a complete withdrawal and even giving up, totally abandoning this guy, given how much this had cost. Now, the Soviets that remained, the advisors, they succeeded in a couple things. With titanic efforts, these advisors that were left behind not only managed to stop the collapse of the DRA, but they were even able to seize the initiative. In April of 1990, there was a major offensive operation. The elimination of what they called the Pagman Salient, which was seen as a springboard for capturing the capital. 3 months of fierce fighting, the army with a formidable force of Ahmad Massoud was defeated. 3 Soviet advisors were killed, but they killed 600 Mujahideen. So on February 15, 1989, according to the Geneva Peace Agreements, the 40th Army left the country. Again, July of 1990, an Afghan DRA offensive was launched near Jalalabad, and it ended with a defeat, this time under Islamic defeat under Hekmatyar. So you have 2 victories, and I it's conceivable that the army knew that they were in serious trouble. The Soviets are gone, so we better get our act together really fast, or we're going to be the ones in prison. Another defeat in the fall of 1990 to retake Khost, again, an Islamic defeat. The army under Mohammad Akhilis that surrounded the city. So in other words, the withdrawal of Soviet troops in 89 did not lead to the immediate collapse of the DRA. For three more years, Najibullah controlled all major cities and struck hard against the Islamic resistance. At the same time, though, he stopped being a communist. He kind of became a semi-Islamic national leader. Remember, the Soviets were going to be gone in a couple of years anyway. But as the Soviets pulled out, the government forces, the DRA controlled 26 out of 28 provinces. But as the next 3 years wore on, and they were in international isolation, the DRA couldn't handle, again, the sophisticated guerrilla tactics of the Mujahideen with a non-functional economy. By this time, all aid had been withdrawn. And for the first half of 1991, he controlled about 10% of the country, and the Soviet Union was largely no more. Now, assessing victory and defeat, if the U.S. collapsed, it couldn't cope with the Taliban resistance, and their puppet government lasted, a couple of hours once the Americans pulled out. Allegedly, the Soviet army was, quote-unquote, legally present in Afghanistan, since they were invited. I don't know if it was official or not, or really begged by the DRA to intervene back in 79. On paper, the plan was for the Soviets to destroy the bulk of the Mujahideen, give the government breathing room, allow the army to reform itself, and slowly have the DRA army take the place of the Soviets as they pulled out. That was the plan. They were not supposed to do the bulk of the fighting. But it is vaguely impressive that Najibullah, the minute he abandoned Marxism, did create, at least for a time, effective security institutions. But he was getting Soviet aid. But only that financial and economic support from the USSR continued. He was eventually overthrown. The Taliban, in 1996, tortured him to death, which, quite frankly, he deserved because he was involved in that when he was head of COD. But then, of course, the entire Soviet Union collapsed. The American-dominated Russian leadership at the time stopped all support for Najibullah. There is an argument that the Mujahideen would not have overthrown the government if the Soviets had continued to exist and provide financial assistance. But when you talk about victory or defeat, in some cases it's obvious, in some cases it isn't. In this case, you have to connect it to the stated reasons for intervention. The Soviets never sought to take over the country, to create a dependent state, to annihilate the Mujahideen, to annex the country, to do anything like that. Of course, the Soviet, when they pulled out, it was trumpeted as a Soviet defeat by all the Mujahideen, all the Muslim states in the area. But you have to remember, as much as we despise the Soviet system, it was still seen as quote-unquote Russian, even though Brezhnev was Ukrainian. It was still seen as Russian, and the way that the West, other than World War II, of course, everything that the Russians ever did from the 19th century on was construed as a defeat by Western intellectuals of any stripe. And as you know from reading me, that's rarely the case. They'll even go so far as to say that this defeat contributed to the collapse of the USSR itself. The reality is that the Mujahideen did not defeat the Soviet army on the battlefield. You really can't speak of victory of anybody here. Yeah, the Soviets could have remained for a few more years, but the USSR was gone. Gorbachev finally realized that this was an impasse, and the stalemate wasn't justified by the high cost anymore. The position of the 40th Army couldn't really be defended politically anymore, even if the USSR had survived. Morton Abramovich, one of the neocons later on, but at the time he was head of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, he stated in 1997 that, and I'm quoting him now, in 1985 we were really worried that the Mujahideen were losing, that their numbers were decreasing, and their units were breaking up. Their losses were high, and the damage they inflicted on the Soviet troops was small. Again, at its peak, the 40th Army had 117,000 men there, probably at a minimum. So a classic military victory was not in the cards. That wasn't their intent. You can't occupy a country with that contingent. In Vietnam, the USA deployed a military force five times larger than the 40th Army in an area like many times smaller than Afghanistan. And the USSR, of course, not only fought rebels, but they built factories, housing, roads, all on the Soviet model, of course. In the course of the war, 15,051 men from the Russian side were killed in Afghanistan. 82.5% of those were combat losses. The DRA lost 26,595, with God knows how many went missing or deserted. Again, the Soviet case, you may have more or less direct, exact data, but not in the Afghan case. The government forces versus civilian versus Mujahideen and the factions thereof, a lot of civilians were secret guerrillas. You know, the common figure in the West is that between 75,000 and 90,000 Mujahideen were killed. But that's a minimum. The UN said that 640,000 people died total, and about half of that were men, combatants or otherwise. Americans, you know, don't think really in sophisticated terms. They see like the action movie trope of victory, you know, victory being a crushing victory. Or they don't understand, you know, basic military operation under these conditions, at least as a historian. They tend to reduce everything to Bruce Willis movies or even an NFL contest. And you have clearly defined plays, penalties, uniforms, agendas. But to be charitable, the Soviet Army successfully completed its mission, at least by the official definition of its stated principles. They quickly took and held the huge majority of the country. Nothing was ever captured by the Mujahideen that was controlled by the Soviets. But the fault lay entirely with the Afghan government, with the humiliation of that government existing. It was probably a little bit better than the American puppet regime. I believe the Soviets were more successful than the Americans, at least as far as Najibullah is concerned. But the entire ideology, the entire system is based on lies and violence. And there are so many lessons to be learned there. And my favorite one is how the DRA, when they were being rescued by the Soviet 40th Army, didn't do anything to help themselves. They just used this as an excuse to kill each other rather than reforming their government and being able to function. Quite possibly that they were aware that they only had a handful of members and that they had absolutely no right to rule a country like that. The Americans learned zero from this and arrogantly went in there because they thought there was some connection with 9/11, whatever they invented to the unwashed, and believed that, well, we're the strongest army in the world, and they found out that they're not. But of course, there was no intent to allow the Afghans to fight this war. That was the Soviet intent. I don't believe it didn't help, but I don't think it brought down the Soviet government. I think there were a lot of other reasons for that. That just shows you, quite frankly, how dumb people are and how many boys have to die. And still, people don't realize how dumb people are in these positions. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.